Hello and welcome. It is Thursday, June the 1st, a brand new month here. It is Pollock and back from Las Vegas, Brandon Thurston. You're back from the West Coast. Are you still moving? Are you still thinking straight, Brandon? It's been a lot of time spent in the air for you over the past couple of days.
Yeah, I've never been to the Pacific time zone before, but now I have. I went to bed early on Tuesday, but I did catch up and watch Dark Side of the Ring, so I'm prepared for today.
Yes, you did the requisite homework as we welcome in our very special guest. He is the co-creator, executive producer of Dark Side of the Ring, which just kicked off its fourth season, airing Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice. He is Evan Husney, who is with us. Evan, how are you today?
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing good, man. Good to be back. Good to be talking with you again, John. And hey, Brandon, how's it going?
Hi.
I've got to ask, Evan, you know, whenever it is the upcoming season of Dark Side, you really pound the pavement when it comes to promoting and getting out there. Is your head just spinning at this point? And because, I mean, I give you guys a lot of credit, man. You guys get out there and really get the word out when it comes to, you know, the time to promote the season.
Oh, man. Thank you so much. Yeah, it has been crazy. I just got back from Toronto actually yesterday. And we did our first ever like cast and crew screening because, you know, the pandemic had kind of shut us down for quite a number of years there. And so we weren't ever able to like get the team together to like celebrate the show ever before. So and I had people who've worked on the show for 3 years and I've never met them in person. So it was pretty crazy. So there's a lot of stuff that's been going on, but it's been great. And the response to the episode has been it's been great. And so, yeah, man, just keeping on keeping on.
I'm going to ask a very Toronto-specific question right now. Are you wearing a Sugo hat?
Yeah, I wore it just for you.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Sugo, yeah. Sugo is...
What is this? Just, I'm from Buffalo.
Man. I mean, to describe this place, like, it's this awesome Italian restaurant that is adorned with all this boxing memorabilia, and it's like 10 minutes from my house, and it is fantastic.
Just to put Sugo over for a minute, I live in New York City. I have access to all the greatest Italian you can imagine here. And I still think, you know, Sugo's king, man. I go to Toronto for Italian. That's how good this place is. You know, so Sugo, if you're ever in Toronto, you got to try it out. It's just amazing. Red sauce, classic, amazing. Yeah.
And it's got a Tim Hortons 30 seconds east of it as well. So anyway.
That's right.
That wraps the interview, everyone. We have
all right,
everything
Sugo,
about
we're
Dark
out.
Side of the Ring. This
Tuesday night to 10.
Yeah.
a question for you is when an episode premieres, sort of how are you sort of, are you online actively as the show is rolling out? Are you watching it and watching it with different eyes, with reaction? What is sort of your sort of habits when it comes to when the premiere of a new episode is dropping?
Well, typically, yeah, I'll definitely look at the response. You know, I know all the big moments that are coming, so I'm always curious to see like the live reaction that people have to certain things. This time around, again, we were with our crew. So it was great to like see it in a theater. We screened it at the Royal there in college. So it was cool just to like, you know, see it in a theater setting like that. So that was a little bit different, but for the most part, yeah, I am watching it in tune with the audience. I'm always curious on what the reaction is going to be. And from what I could tell, it seemed pretty positive. I mean, it wasn't an easy episode to put together. I will say that. There was a lot of, you know, it was like, I'm sure we'll get into this, but you know, there was different roads we could have taken in terms of had we had access to Tammy to do an interview with her, the episode probably would have opened up and probably become a 2-hour. I probably would have been able to sell that more to the network based on that. But so we basically had this like 45-minute sandbox and we had to fit a lot of stuff in. So, and I know that's always the challenge and you gotta let a lot of great stuff go, you know, when you're trying to fit it in into that. But I think all in all, I'm super happy with how it came out, you know, given all of those kind of parameters and restrictions and things like that.
Yeah, I was looking up on the Showbiz Daily website. They post like the top 150 cable originals every day. And I was looking at all the instances where Vice has shown up there and like the top 15 are all Dark Side of the Ring. I think all Dark Side of the Ring. And then there's some more that are Dark Side of this or that.
Yeah.
So I was sort of pleasantly surprised to see there's a fourth season. You know, there was that break there and you guys did Tales of the Territories.
Yeah.
Like what led to the fourth season actually happening?
Well, I mean, I think there was always plans for a fourth season. There probably would have been a move where, you know, during Tales from the Territories, maybe we could have balanced doing both. I was a little hesitant to do both because I really wanted to, you know, I wanted to put a lot of my energy into Tales from the Territories, be very hands-on, and to try and, you know, make it as good as it could possibly be. And I think that if I were spread thin between that and doing Dark Side at the same time, maybe one or the other would have suffered a little more. And so it was just kind of my own choice, I think, at the end of the day, too. So it was always in the cards to do Tales from the Territories. It was like 2.5, maybe even 3 years before it came out that we had been pitching it and wanted to do it. You know, we had met Seven Bucks Productions and, you know, Dwayne's team, and we really wanted to make this. And so that it felt like that was the right time. Like after season three, we take a little break, do our side project. It's like, you know, we're a band. We've done these three records, you know, and now we wanted to try a side project and then get back, you know, and now we're back with the fourth album. So it was always in the, it was always in the plans to do a fourth season. So, it felt really good getting back to it. I do, right as we were wrapping up Territories, we were starting right into season four. There was like no break. There was actually some overlap, and it was like, okay, now we're getting back to, you know, what we do. And that was a great feeling for sure.
Was there ever a time that you felt pretty confident that Tammy would be on board for this episode? Yeah. Or was, and so that sort of broke down as you guys were already in the midst of putting the show together?
Yeah, I thought there was probably a few days of like finger crossing where I felt like it was going to happen. And I was really excited about that. I think it would have taken the episode in a completely different direction. But it was that cutoff deadline of it happening or not, or like us having to move on, was like, it was right up to the wire. Like it would have put us in a pretty tricky position to finish everything on time. But it was right up against that. Like I was waiting, you know, pins and needles, waiting to hear back from the legal team as if this was going to happen. And then ultimately, you know, she was advised, you know, against participating. And I think she wanted to do it. That's the sense that I got, that she wanted to do it. And she might have just done it anyway. But I think she listened to her legal team. And so, you know, which I totally understand. She's got, you know, she's got a court case coming up. She's got all this stuff. You know, you don't want to have anything influence a jury one way or the other. I totally understand that. So, there was a time where I thought, man, this was going to be, you know, which it definitely would have made it epic in a different way for sure.
Yeah, I thought you guys did a fair job of, you know, and John was talking about it last night, because I did listen to his review of it. You know, it would have been easy to sort of paint Tammy in a negative light and consider, you know, the legal problems she's had. Mm-hmm. But I think you guys did a fair job of showing, you know, Chris Candido as being a sympathetic subject and you know, showing the problems that Tammy had. So like, I mean, every one of these episodes, there's a dark side to it. So I'm just wondering, like, how you, like, we think about this as reporters too. How do you avoid being just neutral for the sake of being neutral, but also, you know, tell the truth and be fair while respecting people's families? You know, a lot of people have passed away who you're covering here.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, you know, the name Dark Side of the Ring, I think, kind of evokes a more negative, or maybe could infer like maybe more of like a tabloid approach, you know, to this industry, which never really was our goal. You know, I think more with Dark Side of the Ring, we were hoping with that title is it would be more evocative of sort of the reenactments and the atmospheric kind of quality of the sort of, for lack of a better term, feel like film noir kind of style that we give to the show. But I think what we've always done, even before we had that name, when we were making the first season, which we didn't have the name of the show while we were working on the first season, is that we tried to really create like a human portrait of these wrestlers and these wrestling personalities that we grew up, you know, idolizing. We really wanted to ground them and show them as the real people they are, you know, behind these larger than life sort of, you know, caricature facades. And I think that's what we always try and do, is we lead with empathy. That's what we'd always have tried to do. Like, instead of pointing a finger, judging somebody, or creating like a situation, or showing a situation as very black or white, you know, it's more complicated than that. And so we always try to keep that in mind. And to try and give a very human, empathetic portrait of these people, because we do love this business. And we grew up as huge fans. So we are kind of walking that tightrope, you know, between like our personal feeling, you know, and like affection and for wrestling, but also being faithful to the story. And that's what we try and do, is here's the story. And we try to just, you know, we try to let the like the actual subjects we interview, we try to let them speak and show their point of view, you know, rather than our point of view coming through and it being like, okay, here's how you should feel about this. I think we do a good job of leaving it in the audience's hands at the end of the day. And so those are the main things that we try to keep is like, you know, try to be empathetic, try to lead with the heart, but then also leave it open, you know, for viewers to really come to their own conclusions.
Last year, Johnny Candido, who's really great on this episode, if you haven't already seen it, and John Cosper had put out a book on Chris Candido that's a really great, you know, summary of his life. But one of the people that was part of the book was Chris's father, Don. And one of his quotes is that Christopher's biggest problem and the reason for 99% of his actions and issues was his involvement with Tammy. All I will say here is that if Tammy never entered his life, he would be alive and happy today. And she knows it. It's pretty definitive and harsh criticism of Tammy. In your time sitting down with Peggy and with Johnny, mm-hmm. was that overall the impression you came away with? And sort of tell me a bit about like the process here that it would seem like the family certainly has an opinion of Tammy.
Yeah, that is a really good question. Yeah, it was very obvious just in the conversations. I've read Johnny's book too, you know, as well, leading up to this, which I do recommend, you know, shout out to, you know, Johnny Candido's book about Chris. If you're interested in further reading, it's a great thing to pick up, for this, you know, Chris's story. A lot of eye opening stuff in there. I did find that in my research and in my initial conversations with the family, they obviously have very strong feelings towards Tammy, you know, pretty much sums up what you're saying there from that quote. But I will say when it came time to sit down and to do the interview and to tell the story, they were very conscious of not wanting to, man, for lack of a better term, like take cheap shots or, mm-hmm. you know, to be disrespectful, even if in certain cases it might be warranted, you know. They really wanted to be respectful of her, just even given her present situation. It was almost like, you know, it speaks for itself. That was kind of the impression I got from what they were saying. And I think that was the right approach for them to take, of just like, just objectively, like, you know, they were being very conscious of being respectful and not wanting to, you know, kick somebody when they're down, I guess, if that makes sense. And I think that made the piece stronger at the end of the day, you know, for me, you know, just objectively seeing that.
Is there a different criteria that you look at today in terms of what makes a successful show versus season one when you're trying to get this off the ground, find that following? How have just your own sort of self-evaluation of a show and how it's received changed over the seasons?
Yeah, I think, yeah, season one, I think we were really trying to figure out what that we wanted the show to be. I think in the beginning, we sort of set out for it to really feel like here's an exploration of this kind of exotic world from the point of view, like from outside looking in, like here is, this isn't a show that's going to be for wrestling fans, you know, I mean, obviously, they're going to watch it, but it's for a general audience. It's for people who, you know, have a cursory understanding of what wrestling is, but maybe they've written it off. Maybe they think it's just a bunch of phony BS and, you know, we're not going to pay attention to it. Cause a lot of media before had, you know, a lot of documentaries that were produced, you know, or exposés or news programs or anytime they cover it, they never really gave it the respect because, oh, well, it's just a bunch of fake stuff. And so why should we care? And, you know, and I think that's led to wrestling kind of being in this sort of gray area, you know, where it's not governed by the same rules and logic that, you know, the rest of the real world is. So I thought it would just be fascinating to try and bring a deeper understanding, you know, of this industry and the people behind it for a more general audience. That's like our main goal, right? I think that's evolved over the seasons where, I mean, we've always kept that in mind. We always keep the non-fan in mind and how are we going to make them care about these individuals? How are we going to make them relate to these subjects and these stories? Because you can, I mean, even though this is a crazy world of wrestling, you can really relate to a lot of the stories that are on the show. And I think just like for me, it's, you know, always trying to keep in mind, how can we see the world through the weird lens of wrestling? I think that's another thing. And that's changed over time. But for me, it's maybe it hasn't changed that much. It's just really about this exploration of you have the meeting of a very fantastical heightened world with the consequences of reality, and like the blurred lines of those two things kind of meeting. And I think that's always been the most fascinating aspect. The best episodes of our show are the ones that really examine that tension between those two things. That's what we're always looking for with the episodes, is like that tension, I feel like.
And in season three, there was the Plane Ride from Hell episode, and there was some speculation that maybe there wouldn't be a fourth season because some people would be hesitant about sitting down for interviews with the news that followed out of that episode around Ric Flair and Tommy Dreamer. Was that an issue at all, getting people to tape interviews with you?
It really wasn't. No. I mean, some wrestlers, referenced that, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's like, well, first off, the idea that there wouldn't be another season, to me, was always very, like, I couldn't quite understand that, and I've grown up reading the wrestling newsletters and, a lot of the articles that get written, taking a lot of liberties with some headlines and things like that. And I've always kind of, it's just funny to be part of that ecosystem as a fan now, to like see it firsthand and to experience it where like speculation, snowballs into fact, right?
Somebody else reports it and it's the game.
Yeah. It just keeps going on and on and on. So it's just funny to see how that takes on a life of its own when it's like, no, we had a very successful season and like, there'd be no reason to not make more. But for me, it's like that situation is very simple. It was, this is the story we were telling, and the people we talked to even ahead of time on the phone to like get, okay, what's your story? Okay, great. Then we're going to put you on the show. And this is what they came to share. This is the point of view that they came to share on the show. And we were completely 100% faithful to everybody's point of view and what they wanted to share with that episode. And so I think it got pretty controversial. I don't think really anybody from our side, and even definitely the people who were in the episode felt like it would have that amount of controversy or blowback or whatever. So I do think there was like walking back, some of the things that, were said on the program or and everything. But like for us, it's like, it's never been about, like I was saying earlier, it's never been about like, okay, we're judging somebody and this is a black or white situation, or whatever. This is a complicated situation. And I think for all of us, it's always been at the heart is to tell the story and to be faithful to the point of views of the people that have showed up on camera. And that's, that's what you got with that.
And am I getting the detail right that Heidi Doyle, the flight attendant, she broke an NDA to talk with you for that one?
I'm not sure exactly what her situation was. Okay. It was, if she did or not, it was basically just, reaching out, and then she agreed to do the interview. The other flight attendant we did speak to didn't agree to do the interview.
Okay.
Do you have any idea about that?
I was
just going to ask, did you get feedback from Heidi Doyle on how she felt the episode came across and presented her story? Because, I mean, in all of this controversy, it seems so much was around Ric Flair that Heidi Doyle was somewhat like forgotten in all of this. And here's someone that goes on camera on the record.
I agree.
And speaks about this. And I thought that was kind of an unfortunate part of the controversy and what was focused on.
I agree. I mean, I completely agree with that. To answer the first part of your question, she did contact us after seeing it and thanked us, for sharing her story and her experiences. But I totally agree. I think the takeaway, and she says it in the episode, which I think is one aspect of the takeaway of the episode. It's not like, do I wish harm on this person or, am I trying to, take a shot at this person? No, it's about maybe if this story and hearing this story, and I think this goes for a lot of the episodes that we do, Grizzly Smith, Chris Benoit, whatever, Owen Hart, is how can you see this story, hear this story, and examine maybe your own experiences? Maybe you were subject to a similar experience, or maybe you did something to somebody else and you should, maybe examine your behavior, and maybe that helps you, relate to this story on some level. And I think that, in my opinion, was kind of, or should have been at least the big takeaway from it, and I think to people outside of the wrestling world, I think it probably was.
And like how much cooperation has there been with WWE? I noticed like for one thing, there's a lot of WWE clips that if we included like on one of our YouTube videos, we would probably get a copyright strike or something, but there's a ton of WWE footage in there. So I was wondering if there's some kind of agreement there.
No, we have no, agreement, you know, with WWE, you know, we're, you know, independent doc production, you know, telling these stories in a journalistic light. And that allows you, you know, some
so this is fair use
legal. Yeah. And, you know, with Tales from the Territories, you know, we were able to get access to, it's a different show. We were able to get access to some of the talent from WWE. So we had that, relationship, but there's no official relationship at all with WWE for Dark Side of the Ring. You know, I mean, Jerry McDivitt showed up on our season 3 finale, which I would imagine, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that he, you know, had to get some permission for that, but there's no, you know, formal, you know, relationship between the two.
Yeah, of all the episodes I've seen, like that was the most captivating one to me, is just Jerry McDivitt talking about his relationship with Vince. I came away from that being like, somebody could write a movie just about like the relationship between those two. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a really interesting opportunity for us to be able to, you know, tell a story from within WWE, you know, from someone who's so close to Vince and who's been there through so many, you know, the controversies and the legal battles and things like that. It's just a very interesting, I think, fresh new perspective for us to be able to get. And and I totally agree. I was very, very excited when we were able to work with him on that. I think that kind of, you know, was a step in a different direction for sure.
You produce so many of these episodes, you get this direct feedback, and you saw sort of the fallout regarding Ric Flair. But in another sense, you bring up Vince McMahon, and it's something very interesting about this industry that I think that there's a lot of reverence for these figures that a lot of the audience has grown up idolizing that, yeah. I think that there is not the same standard that some of these people that would be held in different industries. And I'm kind of curious about your own thoughts about just professional wrestling. And it seemed that, you know, with the Ric Flair thing, it made me uneasy that it was almost as though, well, This is too big of a star to take down. This is making me uncomfortable as a fan. And I think like that is, it's almost like this tiered system of where this idolization of certain people that it's like they are above just basic, you know, stories that are reflected on their reputation.
Well, it's a complicated thing. You know, it's something our culture has been examining now, I think, you know, for the past several years. I think it goes hand in hand a little bit with what I was saying before, which is any other form of entertainment, any other form of, you know, besides wrestling, I feel like, you know, accountability would be much more of the common expectation. I feel like, I think in wrestling, there is this harder, firmer line between, you know, the person who they are in real life and the person who they portray on camera. You know, and it's so mixed together and it's so blurred that I think it's allowed this industry, you know, a lot of leeway in certain ways, the way it's looked at by like government agencies, the way it's looked at by, you know, insurance companies, the way it's looked at by a lot of different levels of scrutiny, I think it's unique in that way. I think if a similar situation occurred in any other field, it would be a completely different response, I feel like.
What have you learned in terms of, like, so much is focused upon, like, the number of that first airing on a Tuesday night on Vice? Like, what do you feel is, in terms of, like, consumption? Like, there are many ways to consume Dark Side of the Ring. What do you feel like Vice TV puts the most value on? Have you been, like, part of those discussions? And what have you just learned about the television industry in 2023?
I mean, I'm not a huge part of those conversations. I mean, sometimes I'll put my opinion on, you know, what episode I think should open the season and which one I think should end it. And you can't really choose that all the time because it does relate to the production schedule a lot of the times. Like, for example, there's only, I think, 4 episodes that are finished of the season right now. And the other 6, we're actually shooting stuff right now, like in the studio as we speak for, I think we're shooting stuff today for the Bam Bam Bigelow episode. So you have to imagine that like we're shooting stuff right now that's going to be on the air in 7 weeks. So it's a pretty intense, like, schedule we have. That being said, to answer your question, like, yeah, there isn't a lot of input or thing, you know, I mean, ratings to me, it's like this thing I'm trying to like fully understand, you know, we still are part of the broadcast cable world, like wrestling is, you know, like professional wrestling shows are, but I think our show has taken on these different lives where, yeah, people watch it on broadcast, probably more of the wrestling crowd watches it on broadcast cable because that's how they're used to watching wrestling, right? Every week.
They're evergreen. I mean, this is not like,
yeah,
like right. There's not a whole lot of fans, I think, just pop on a episode of Raw from 2 months ago, but
exactly.
These, they have great value in terms of, you know, for,
they do. Yeah. They do. And that was a huge part of me petitioning to get the show greenlit in the first place was, you know, it was a previous regime at Vice. It's a completely, totally different regime than it was that it is today, or it has been since around like season two of the show. But it was really, really, really hard to get this show across the green light zone because there was no familiarity with that wrestling audience. And it was just kind of that age old stereotype of like, you know, wrestling fans aren't affluent and they're not mean, their ratings don't mean anything and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, no, I mean, and it was right at the rise of AEW. It was right when AEW had announced the TV deal that they were getting. And it was like, look, you have two major companies now in these different cable channels. And that was a huge part of being able to convince Vice in order to finally pull the trigger to air these shows because they were sitting on a shelf for a little bit. And so then there was that aspect of it. But yeah, it's funny, like the non-wrestling fans, the ones that were kind of gearing the show towards, they sort of kind of come in, I think, more when it's like on Hulu. It's that second window down in the States. You don't have Hulu up in Canada, but you know, you guys have Crave. But like,
I have Hulu, don't worry.
Okay. Don't worry. But I think a lot of people just rediscovered the show during the pandemic via Hulu when the episodes finally hit there. And I think that was a second wave of enthusiasm for the show, which kind of helped us getting into, you know, season three and season now four. Yeah.
And Vice seems to embrace wrestling more since then, right? Like,
absolutely.
They're airing Women of Wrestling at like 1 a.m. apparently in the last couple of months.
I didn't even know that. Wow. Yeah.
And an MLW special and Tales of the Territory. But I know Vice Media Group is going through bankruptcy, and
yeah.
I don't know if you anticipate that's going to have any impact on Dark Side of the Ring or anything like that.
No, I mean, my understanding, you know, from a lot of the meetings that I've been a part of and, you know, talking to, you know, people who are way above my pay grade over there and who are more part of the day to day of the company. Obviously, I'm, you know, I just work on the show and they air it, you know, so I'm not part of any of those conversations. But from what I gather, you know, Vice TV is a separate entity from the Vice Media Group, you know, and Vice Studios is as well, which produces a lot of the content internally, like, you know, films, documentaries, doc series, things like that, internally and externally for other platforms like Netflix, Amazon, whatever, HBO. And those are separate companies. So it's really kind of the core digital business, you know, Vice Media Group that is, you know, going through the Chapter 11 process right now. So as far as everything we've been told and everything, you know, that we, as we understand, you know, the Vice TV shows, from a production standpoint and from the television channel standpoint, are completely unaffected by what's going on otherwise. But again, I'm not a official, you know, person, you know, representative.
There's your headline coming out of this.
I know. God.
Evan Husney on the future of Vice TV revealed.
It's already out there. It's already out there. It's already on turnbucklenews.net.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My last question is, next week you've got a Magnum TA, which is like a really inspiring story on Terry Allen. But I would say of the 10 episodes, the one I am most intrigued by is, June 13th with the Graham family. And this is, I just find Eddie Graham to be such a interesting figure that we've gotten like bits and pieces and he influenced so many people. But like for those going in cold, like it's a very, very sad story involving the Graham family and like generational issues of like of suicide. And I don't know if people are necessarily going into this with I'm really fascinated by that episode, and I'm sure it was a really interesting one, and I was glad that you guys went this direction to look at the Graham family.
It's definitely a heavier one for sure, and there is you know, appropriate trigger warnings at the top of the episode because it does deal with, you know, pretty heavy conversation of, a generational tragedy of, you know, suicide almost being passed down, you know, like this hereditary thing through the generations of this family. And it extends four generations, which is so crazy. I mean, you have Eddie Graham, one of the best, most amazing visionary minds in wrestling history, you know, promoter of championship wrestling from Florida, which we covered a lot in Tales from the Territories when we did that up, when we did that episode. And this kind of led to finally doing this for season four. It had been always pitched to us, like Dutch Mantel had said, you got to do the Graham family, or Jim Cornette, you got to do the Graham family. And so finally we really looked at it, especially, you know, like, as I said, after Territories. And, so Eddie Graham, his father and uncle took their own lives. He eventually would take his own life. His son, Mike Graham, who went on to be a wrestler and also, you know, an important figure backstage at WCW during the 90s heyday, he would take his own life, and his son took his own life. Not necessarily all in that order, but, you know, it kind of echoes back to the Von Erich episode of season one, just kind of looking at here's sort of like this, you know, this just relentless, kind of unfathomable familial tragedy one after the other. And so for us, you know, it was pretty heavy to look at all that, but of course we wanted to find some meaning in that in order to, you know, like what's the motivation to sort of go there on that journey and bring fans and viewers, you know, through that journey. And really the heart and the soul of the episode is Mike Graham's daughter, Nicole, who you hear from. I don't think she's ever really done an interview or talked very much about this, but she is sort of the one to break the cycle, if you will, in the family. And that's kind of her big message. That's the title of the episode. It's Breaking the Cycle, the Graham Dynasty. And I think, you know, she's become a big mental health advocate, you know, raising awareness, you know, for this and suicide prevention. And that is a big part of the episode. But it is a roller coaster ride of the episode. It does get into, obviously, you know, how great Eddie was and Mike and the territory, you know, at the height of its powers and things like that. But it definitely gets into some grim territory. Absolutely. But at least at the end, there's a very, you know, positive, inspirational takeaway.
And then the other subjects this season include Junkyard Dog, Adrian Adonis, Bash at the Beach 2000, Abdullah the Butcher, Bam Bam Bigelow, and then the season finale is on Marty Jannetty. Did you request that as the finale?
I request it. I did, actually. I did, and it was able to work out that the schedule-wise that we were able to do that. It's a pretty unique episode, I will say that. I've mentioned this on other interviews leading up to it. It was something, I can't remember the timeline exactly, but it seems like to me when that story emerged about him potentially, you know, killing somebody in a bowling alley, I think that emerged when we were in production on season three, I want to say. And that's when it really, you know, all the dark side memes started coming out, you know, when that news hit, you know. And that's what's kind of fun to watch. You know, you see like a modern controversy unfold in wrestling, and then you see all the dark side fan edits or memes that kind of pop up on social media. It's kind of fun to see, but it was really happening during then. And then it was kind of like, yeah, what would a Marty Jannetty episode look like? And then I think we made the right choice in that, you know, most of the interviews we do for the show, it's like, okay, we're setting up, we're with the person for maybe 2 to 3 hours, we're in, we're out, that's it, you know. And that's all we're pretty much, that's just time wise and what we're allowed to pretty much do in order to, you know, keep on schedule. But for this, we knew that would just not be the right call. Like, I think to really understand Marty and to get the true essence of him, you know, we had to sort of embed with him for several days, and that's what we did. We actually spent a total of 4 days with him, which is the most we've ever been with anybody on the show. So I think that it has a different kind of verite feel to it than I think most of the other episodes do. And it really examines, obviously, his rise, you know, to stardom with Shawn Michaels. But it's obviously a lot of that kind of more, no pun intended, post-wrestling kind of life where, you know, yeah, he had a lot of opportunities after Shawn Michaels, like after the Rockers, to kind of try to recapture, you know, that. But I think he kind of squandered, self-sabotaged. You know, he had gone through a lot of drug issues and problems. And we do get into that. But we also get into this kind of like fantasy universe that Marty has kind of created, I think, you know, from being out of the spotlight for so many years, it's kind of perpetuating that same sort of, you know, fictitious storyline universe, you know, despite being out of wrestling for a while. And he's an incredible amount of pain as well, too, which is just crazy. We interviewed his doctors and we asked his doctors, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain is Marty in on a day-to-day basis? And they were like, 12. You know, it's 12. And so, so we really get into that. I think it's really a portrait of somebody in wrestling who made a big impact, who's still with us and, you know, trying to become used to being out of the spotlight.
Can you say, is that going to be one of the longer episodes? It's going to be beyond 60 minutes?
No, it's a traditional episode length. Yeah.
One final question. We'll let you go, Evan. This is a super chat that comes in from our man, Neil. Can any use be made of the unaired portions of the interviews? For example, could they be released in a companion podcast or transcribed in a companion book? Could you see any repurposing for, I mean, you must be sitting on just hours and hours.
We are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question, Neil. You know, one of the things I've been pitching, and maybe I'll just put it out there, and if people have, you know, if there's enthusiasm for this, then maybe it'll help me in my pitching process. But we've been approached by a couple of like podcast production companies or, you know, whatever, producers, about, you know, what could a Dark Side of the Ring kind of like podcast look like? And to me, there's so much great footage that we have. Obviously, I mean, you have to imagine, like I said, every interview we do is at least 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think like Bret Hart is 5, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, man, you know, Cornettes can be, you know, 4, you know, they're long. And there's so much great stuff there, side stories, you know, and some of the time, sometimes, unfortunately, some of these are kind of the last real big interview of some of these wrestlers who've left us since. Like, I think about, you know, Road Warrior Animal or New Jack or, you know, people who've left us since doing the interview. And they're kind of these last big interviews. So I think it would be cool, and I've tried to pitch it, is where it's like a podcast series where we're, I think that's the best format for it, honestly. You know, instead of like, I think extended episodes would be tough to do because, you know, look, we go into the studio, we shoot reenactments, we only shoot the stuff we need, and there's, you know, it would kind of, I don't know, it'd be difficult to do like extended versions. But I think
perfect
having
for
sort
a
of
podcast, yeah.
For a podcast, yeah, just to like, you know, maybe one of us is like editorializing it or, you know, framing these long form interviews. And I'm sure fans would love to just, you know, go to town on some of these. And there are a lot of great ones out there, or even folks, none come to mind, who didn't make maybe final, you know, cuts of the episode, or, you know, or only them very briefly. So yeah, I think that'd be very cool. I'd love to do that someday. So I've definitely been thinking about it and trying to pitch it.
All right. Well, everyone, you can check out season 4 of Dark Side of the Ring Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern on Vice. Evan, thanks for being so generous with your time. All the best this season. And next time you're up in Toronto, we can go grab a meatball.
Oh my God. Sugo, you and me will do it. Absolutely. Thanks for having me again, guys. I really appreciate it. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Evan.
There we go. Evan Husney from New York City. Brandon, maybe we'll go to Sugo Forbidden Door weekend.
Okay, we'll go.
There might not be time. You're
right before the Forbidden Pour, maybe.
That's right. That's right. A great pre-meal before the Forbidden Pour. So yes, that is coming up. In a quick nutshell, how was your trip to Las Vegas?
It was very good. I was only there for like 24 hours, something like that. I got to walk around. I had some time between when I got to the hotel and when the show started. So I walked around. I don't know. I've heard of this thing called the Las Vegas Strip. I don't know. I'm sure I was near it, but I was, you know, I was in a hotel very close to T-Mobile Arena, and it was like tourist city. And there's a roller coaster and Statue of Liberty, and something that looks like the Empire State Building. Even though, yes, I was in Las Vegas, not New York City. Very hot. Definitely a desert. There's mountains in the distance, which I've never experienced before.
You should have gone up there with Wheeler Yuta, done some neck bridges.
Yeah, no, thank you. but yeah, it was good. The show was, you know, it was a good experience. I know it was not reviewed as the best AEW pay-per-view, but the press conference experience was good. As we sit here, I have, I mean, I didn't have this while Evan was on. I have Dark Side of the Ring ratings.
Oh, well, why don't you drop them on us? Cause I have not seen them.
Six, let's see here. 147,000 viewers is what the Chris and Tammy episode did. 147,005 in the demo.
Oh, 05.
This is exclusive here, folks.
That's an exclusive. I'm just,
I don't think this is on Showbuzz.
So yeah, the last, season of, Dark Side, we had the last episode was the steroid trials, which was back in 2021. So that finale did 154,000.06. And that was the second highest of the season. The big one in, okay, they split up the season. So this second half, you had Chris Canyon doing 214,000, Dynamite Kid 242,000, Grizzly Smith did 243. The big one was Pillman. Pillman did 272.
Yeah. And that was a 2-hour episode.
That was a 2-hour episode. So, yeah, 140 is sort of on the lower end of some of these, although it was ahead of some of these episodes. You know, it was ahead of like XPW, Luna, Johnny Canine, FMW. So, it was interesting to hear about sort of, you know, Tammy Sitch and what her involvement would or would not have been if it was, it seems, you know, as Evan stated, like at a point they thought they would have her.
And she's actually in prison right now, I think.
I believe, yeah, I don't think she is.
So presumably she would be interviewing from prison.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that she's awaiting her trial. And yeah, there have been, you know, cases where, you know, you can still do an interview from prison, yeah. But I can
Charlie
understand
Manson
why.
Did.
That's it. So. I don't know how much difference, maybe that opens up, the door, especially if it's a 2-hour episode. Again, I think if you read the book, like it is much more harsh on like Tammy Sitch and hearing from the father of Chris Candido and Johnny as well. But it sounds like, you know, for this series, they did not want to maybe necessarily just trash Tammy here, but it's a good companion if you have seen the Dark Side episode. Did you have any other thoughts on the episode having watched it?
Not especially. I mean, next week is Magnum TA, and I'm biased, and I'm awaiting the reenactment silhouettes of Megabyte Magnum TA, which Megabyte Ronnie is apparently the person who is doing the reenactments for Magnum TA.
Okay, that's a good casting call.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen a picture of him like taking a picture backstage or whatever you would call it, and it looks very correct, very appropriate.
Do you have any medical updates on any security guards that took fireballs at Double or Nothing?
No, I don't. I don't have any medical updates.
This was a Brandon Thurston trainee that was, you know, you got to see his face lit on fire by the Wizard, Chris Jericho.
Eric Kubiak, and I think he's done like a AW Dark match or something like that somewhere along the lines.
Well, we have put it off long enough because on Wednesday night, big announcement, Brandon. I don't know if you heard this. You were traveling a lot this week. Mm-hmm. CM Punk will be on the debut episode of Collision on June the 17th at the United Center in Chicago. WrestleTix has reported that they are around 6,800 tickets distributed. And I guess we will be very focused on not just that show, but all the ensuing collisions to see what kind of bump that these shows get, with the expectation that Punk will be on these Collision episodes, although he has only been formally announced for the Chicago date.
He's on the artwork for the Greensboro Coliseum graphic. So, I mean, I assume he's going to be on all of these if he doesn't have some suspension or conflict before then. I'm looking at the WrestleTix spreadsheet, and it's for Hamilton, which is the, you know, the low one, is still under 1,000, 730. But you know, this is not since Punk has been announced, so we'll see if that has any impact. I'm kind of expecting that there's not going to be a ton of movement here. Maybe there will be a little bit of movement right now. So maybe the latest WrestleTix updates on these shows will show as much as 1,000 up, something like that. But again, I mentioned it before, that interview that Raphael Morphy did with Chris Jericho a couple of weeks ago, or came out a couple of weeks ago, where he says, you know, it's the on-sale dates, that's where, I think he said something like 60% of it happens, and then you get something like 30% at the end. And I'm sure this is an unusual case where you have a really significant announcement in the middle of this timeline, but I imagine a lot of that action is still going to happen towards the end. So again, I think it's an evaluation to make once these shows are in the books.
Do you think that there was a magic number of tickets sold last week that would have been the tipping point for them of, do we announce Punk? Do we not announce Punk? Like, obviously, if this thing sells out, I don't know if they're announcing Punk, but I'm curious. Like, they moved, obviously, like 6,000 to 7,000. Do you feel this announcement would have been made regardless in advance of the show?
Depends on really what their creative plans are and like what Tony and Punk want to do in terms of how they debut him. But sure, if it's sold out, if that United Center sold out in a day or something, you don't have to announce him. And then that sort of signal that clearly everybody gets it. And that should tell you that all those other locations, the prospective ticket buyers get it. But it could well be that, hey, ticket sales are not great here. They're not a home run. So maybe we should make it explicitly clear that CM Punk is going to be there.
Yeah. So the updated list of dates. So they have the debut Collision in Chicago, the next Saturday in Toronto that is not doing significant numbers yet. Then that week they do Wednesday and Thursday in Hamilton, with the Thursday being the Collision date. July 8th is in Regina, the 15th in Calgary at the Saddle Dome. July 22nd is in Newark, and they have just added Collision dates for August 5th in Greenville, South Carolina, and August 12th in Greensboro, which Brandon mentioned, the Greensboro Twitter account, like the advertising, it features CM Punk right on the ad. And they've also added dates for August 2nd in Tampa for a Dynamite Rampage taping at the Yingling Center, which is where was the home of one of the eras of the WWE Thunderdome during the pandemic.
That's right. And I don't think they've been to Tampa. And I know they had advertised this as their first show in that venue. I don't know if they've been to the Tampa metro area before. I'm sure they've been close somewhere else in Florida, though. But yeah.
And so these will be, I think, very interesting shows to monitor and see what the appetite is here. Like, if you get a big surge in these markets, I think that's a massive feather in CM Punk's cap that he's coming in. And for those curious, on the AEW site, for all the Collisions, they have the same poster featuring MJF, Orange Cassidy, FTR, House of Black, Miro, Samoa Joe, Thunder Rosa, Powerhouse Hobbs, and Andrade. And they have not been updated yet to include CM Punk on any of these, but I would imagine that they might be making alterations to that. But that remains to be seen of, are there going to be specific talent earmarked for Collision? Are we going to have a mixture going back and forth? And that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I'm looking at the tweet right now from the Greensboro Coliseum Complex. They have tweeted a graphic with the AEW Collision logo and the date and CM Punk's face. So at least they're advertising it that way. Yeah.
You had no run-ins with CM Punk on the Strip or in Vegas?
I flew through Chicago, and I had my binoculars out. I had my magnifying glass out, and I was strolling through the terminal. I did not find him, though. He was not on my flight.
No, you didn't see the guy facing the hard camera with the Phil with two L's is a cancer sign?
No, I didn't see that. I haven't seen the TV telecast, I guess.
This was briefly, the guy was like on the hard camera side and the sign was visible and then it was gone within.
Do you think they took it away from him? Do you think they're censoring anti-punk sentiment?
I mean, all I can say is I saw it once and I never saw it again. So, I mean, I don't know what happened to the sign, but I mean, you get this on camera. It's like, yeah, you also spelled Phil with two L's. So, I mean.
Yeah. There was a Variety article.
Yes.
Yesterday. Interviewing Tony Khan, just with talking about FAST, which is free ad-supported television, which are platforms such as Pluto, Tubi, there's others. Tony Khan is quoted as saying, as we build a great library of historical content, it presents more and more opportunities for a potential FAST entry, I think. I think that's a decision we need to make in part with our domestic media partners, with Warner Brothers Discovery, who have a great presence in the world of streaming, and figure out what makes sense for us in terms of our partnership. So just doing some thinking about this earlier this afternoon, I'll have a write-up about it in the news update for subscribers today, just along the lines of, you know, and I was talking to somebody who works in, you know, who does content, who has content on a FAST platform. And I guess that's a way better way to monetize video versus YouTube, in terms of the ad rates that you can get. So obviously AEW is on YouTube. They probably make some money. It's probably not that much. WWE is very fortunate to be one of the most popular channels on YouTube. And maybe they have some sort of special deal, I would think, with YouTube. They may even be selling ads directly against some of their content on YouTube. But clearly, I mean, unlike WWE, AEW has not sold or monetized in any way, their next day rights for Dynamite, Rampage, and they'll have another show to sell too, next day rights to Collision. And if you're in the US anyway, I think you can get that stuff on demand as part of the Fight subscription, I would think, right? But there's no Hulu like, platform to consume AEW weekly TV on. So maybe that's a way that they could do that. But I bet what this is looking into is whether, you know, AEW is going to do a fast channel. And I would see that not being a streaming service unto itself, but a channel that gets distributed on these various fast platforms, I would think. So I think they're looking into doing a fast channel that would have their content on it, perhaps Ring of Honor content on it, and weighing whether, hey, you know, WBD, do you want to put us on Max and make it worth our while and pay us so that we do that instead? So we'll see if that happens. And I know there's talk about All In, where that's going to be telecast, and maybe that's going to be on Fast. I believe now, though, that Max has not telecast any live, you know, program yet in its history. Maybe that's something, I think inevitably you're going to have some sort of live sports or live news on Max. I think they've kind of been explicit about wanting to put news on there.
Yes.
But is that going to happen before August 27th? Cause I don't believe they have the capability to broadcast anything live. So it makes me more bearish on the idea that All In is really going to be on a streaming service live. So what does that leave as the options? I guess it's pay-per-view or traditional TV. Maybe it ends up on TNT or TBS. Sort of weighing it out, though, that obviously the hazard is, do you want to run a pay-per-view on one weekend and then the very next weekend run All Out as a pay-per-view? That's going to cause a lot of kicking and screaming among some fans if you do. But thinking it through, I mean, like if I'm WBD, how much am I going to pay for it's a big event and maybe it'll do better than a Dynamite rating even does, maybe on a Sunday afternoon. But how much is that worth to WBD? I mean, I think a Dynamite telecast is in ad revenue is not even worth what their current deal is paying them in a rights fee. So that's like $800,000 a week that Dynamite and Rampage are getting. And I think, you know, what would All In generate in terms of ad revenue? I would think it would be well under $1 million, let's say. I think I can safely say that. So weigh that against what a pay-per-view would generate. Let's say, you know, I don't know, 100,000 buys or something like that. And I think that's way over net revenue just to AEW, way over $1 million. So I guess just purely thinking in a business sense, it makes more sense to make this a pay-per-view. And I would add in also the point that pay-per-view historically has proved to be a pretty inelastic product. So by that, I mean, no matter what you price it as throughout the history of wrestling pay-per-view, the demand has stayed pretty much the same. There's other factors involved with demand, including the quality of the card and the brand and all that. But I think you make more money certainly doing it that way. The question is how much is it a cost of pissing off your fans maybe by running pay-per-views and charging them $50 on two consecutive weekends? So I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Well, I think with All In, if there is no definitive broadcast plan yet, I think you're weighing the options of what is the most profitable option. You would certainly argue like pay-per-view for that night versus the idea of, okay, maybe this is something that we take at a loss by putting it on broadcast, but here is essentially a 3-hour commercial for AEW on national television that the true value of that will be realized in months and years to come, that this is something that hopefully would appeal to whether it be advertisers, business partners, to turn on and see, wow, here is professional wrestling in front of 65,000 people. And this is a major league product. Not all that different. People that were following The Ultimate Fighter during like its glory days, they, you know, it built up to this rematch between Tito Ortiz and Ken Shamrock, and they did a phenomenal number on pay-per-view. This was in the summer of 2006, but it was a semi-disputed finish. So they did a third fight between them and they opted to put it on free television, and it did a monstrous number in October that year. And it was, you know, you probably could have put it on pay-per-view and it would have done maybe not what the second fight did, but it was not going to bomb by any stretch. But they put it on free television on Spike, and it was a big turning point for them by just being able to have these television numbers that were through the roof and help accelerate their growth. Now that's a totally different generation. And what does an AEW big event do on a Sunday afternoon on a TNT or a TBS? I mean, I don't know, like without a card or sense of how much anticipation there would be, like what is your ceiling for that? But that could be the thinking too, if they had that option on the table.
And I think that's a valid way to think about it. I have to edit my write up here that there's a marketing value in projecting this telecast to the widest possible audience, at least in the United States, and taking a lot less money for it than you can make, maybe practically nothing versus, I don't know, making $2 million on pay-per-view. There's an argument there.
And to refresh people's memories, when Mega Parekh was on, I think it was the A to Z wrestling podcast, she had, that was where, you know, she stated that, you know, we're going to All In and then we're coming back for All Out the next weekend. And I would think she's not just assuming that, oh, we always run Labor Day All Out, but Tony Khan much more cards close to the vest this past weekend at the press
club. I would think she would be among the people who would know.
She would be in that circle where I think she would know the schedule a couple months out. But yeah, Tony Khan has not revealed the plans yet for All Out. I would think the idea of back-to-back pay-per-views, that to me would be, why are we running All Out that weekend then? Like, push it off to another weekend, because I do not see that serving much of a purpose. So there you have it. That is the latest in AEW. So you are working on your news update for today. So if you want to learn more about this, you can check it out at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And Wei Ting and I, if you want to check out our review of Chris and Tammy, the premiere episode of season 4 of Dark Side of the Ring, that is up for Post Wrestling Cafe members at postwrestlingcafe.com. We're going to be doing like 30-minute reviews each Wednesday after Dynamite, chatting this current season of Dark Side of the Ring, if you want to follow along. But a big thank you to Evan Husney for joining us and all of you jumping in live, including Neil Flanagan with the super chat. Maybe he has just inextricably launched a companion podcast for Dark Side of the Ring that people can look forward to and hear Bret Hart talk for hours about his entire career, which I have interviewed the man for hours. I mean, the man can go.
Well, when you're that great, you got a lot to say.
Yeah, he's never at a loss. So there you go. Canadian Walk of Fame inductee, yes. Bret the Hitman Hart, who got his star on the Walk of Fame last week.
Yep.
Will be a landmark that I'm sure wrestling fans will be flocking to in a couple of weeks when they're up here. So that is it. And WrestleNomics this Sunday will feature Chris Gullo and Brandon Thurston.
It will feature me and MJ from NJ.
Oh my goodness, MJ getting the call up. Okay.
Yes, Jesse and Gullo are both off this coming Sunday. Boy. So we're calling in our designated hitter.
Okay. The CM Punk of WrestleNomics. It is MJ from NJ who will be coming up and dropping his pipe bomb. So look out for that this coming weekend. And thanks to everyone for joining us. We will be back next week. You won't believe who we have as a guest. We don't know either, but look out for us next week. That is it for us. Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.